The 100 Years' War, Violence in Western France. Well, the work of the two kings was almost immediately swept away in a tide of fresh violence in Western France. During the autumn of 1357, Martin Enriquez arrived at Cherbourg from Navarre with nearly 1,400 reinforcements. Allowing for casualties and desertions, this must have brought the total number of Navarrese troops in Western France to well over 3,000 men. In addition, English, Gascon, and German soldiers of fortune have been pouring into the region all year. Towards the end of the year, the principal English and Navarrean captains in Lower Normandy launched a coordinated offensive from Honfleur in the Seine Valley and the Ile-de-France. The leading light was an Englishman named James Pipe. Pipe was a Stratfordshire knight who had begun his career as a protege of the Earl of Stafford. He had served Stafford in Scotland in the 1340s and had briefly held the office of Keeper of the Berwick-on-Tweed. He had fought with him at the Siege of Calais. And when the Earl went to Gascony as a royal lieutenant in 1352, Pipe went with him. He became the first English captain of Blaye after the recapture of the place from the French, and after Stafford's return to England in October, actually served as acting seneschal of the duchy. Unfortunately, for ambitious retainers like Pipe, the Earl of Stafford played little part in the military campaigns of the mid-1350s. Which was no doubt why Pipe transferred his allegiance to the Duke of Lancaster. He joined Lancaster's expedition in Normandy in 1356 and served with him at Rennes. When the Duke left France in July of 1357, Pipe remained behind as one of the two lieutenants charged with protecting his interests in the West. But it was never entirely clear in what capacity he was acting. Like so many English soldiers of the time, he occupied an ambiguous position. Never wholly amenable to the orders of the king's ministers, but not quite an independent freebooter either. The first important step came with the capture of Le Nuremberg, a market town with an ancient capital where the roads from Rouen, Tours, and Paris met. The English had established a garrison here by the early part of autumn 1357. From which they were able to obstruct much of the road system of southern Normandy and range freely over the whole of the fertile territory between the Seine and the Rizel. Then, on November the 9th, 1357, in the middle of the night, a troop of Englishmen and Germans from Harfleur fell on the town of Pont-Audemer. Pont-Audemer had a very large royal garrison, but 50 of its numbers were German mercenaries. They were turned by the Germans fighting with the English, and they let them into the town. The rest of the defenders fought as courageous rearguard action in the streets until they were cornered and forced to surrender. The citadel, which had a separate garrison, held out. But there was nothing that they could do. They watched impotently from their walls as the invaders pillaged and burnt the town below them. From Pont-Audemer, English and Navarrese burned the trail up the left bank of the Seine River. By mid-December, they had invaded the Ile-de-France and penetrated within a few miles of Paris. Villepreux and Trappes, two small seigneurial castles on the road from Paris to Chartres, were occupied by English garrisons. A few days later, another English company occupied the small town of Mol, south of Mantes. Penetrating east across the forest of Fontainebleau, the English appeared around Montereau, one of the nodule points of the lacework of navigable rivers east of Paris. By the end of the year, 1357, the first English garrisons had penetrated into Champagne, where several fortified manors around Provence were reported to have fallen into their hands. From each of these centers, small groups spread out, seizing merchandise on the roads, burning villages, taking travelers for ransom, and butchering those who were not worth the trouble. The numbers involved are very small. Estimates vary between 800 and 1200 for the whole Paris region. These were probably actually too high, but there was no one to resist them. The population was frozen in panic. West of Paris's, the villages were deserted as inhabitants crammed through the gates of the capital, laden with their possessions. The nuns of Poissy, Longchamp, and Melun abandoned their buildings, closed their doors, and joined the mass of people clogging the roads to the city. The agreement with King John II and the King of England, Edward III, was a serious threat to Charles of Navarre. Like many other Frenchmen, he probably underestimated the remaining diplomatic obstacles and assumed that the king's release from captivity was imminent. The end of the war, or a premature return of the French king to his country, could only reinforce the position of the crown and undermine his. So when the first news of the agreement reached Paris, around December the 9th, 1357, Charles embarked on what can only be regarded as a deliberate attempt to hasten the disintegration of the French state and satisfy his demands before the first installment of the ransom could be found and paid to Edward III. He had all the prisons of Paris opened, like those of Amiens a month before. Their occupants were released into a brawling mass into the streets of the city. The Dauphin, with little more than a cipher in the hands of Charles's friends, meekly sealed the necessary orders. The Estates General, or the rump of it, which was still in Paris, was formally adjourned in the middle of January. As for the King of Navarre's negotiations with the Dauphin, they were brought to an abrupt and inconclusive end. Charles's territorial claims were referred to the adjudication of a commission comprising the Dowager Queens and two nominees of the Dauphin, assisted by the three estates when they eventually reconvened. On December the 13th, 1357, the King of Navarre left Paris to build up his strength in Normandy. His great cavalcade of forces forced its way along the roads packed with refugees, pressing on, coming in the other direction. Now, in Charles's absence, the Dauphin struggled to free himself from the politicians. Robert Lecoq exercised an iron grip on the government. He dominated the council, controlled all the principal administrative departments. He had the support of the leaders of Paris. He was virtually the agent of the King of Navarre. He luxuriated in his newfound status, issuing statements and orders without reference to the Dauphin or any of the other in the council. At the beginning of the new year, he was at the height of his power. He had letters drawn up in the Dauphin's name calling on the Pope to make him a cardinal. But the ambitious prelate readily made enemies, even among those he shared principles with. There was a sizable group of noblemen who found Robert's overbearing manner absolutely intolerable. Some of them regarded the King of Navarre as a dangerous schemer whose actions could only help the English. In the course of December 1357, three men emerged as the leading members of this group. Jean de Conflans, the honorary marshal of the County of Champagne, Gerard de Cherny, who held the same office in the Duchy of Burgundy, were prominent, well-connected noblemen on the Dauphin's council. They came from profoundly conservative regions in eastern France, up to this point untouched by the fighting. Robert of Clermont, the Marshal of Normandy, and the Dauphin's lieutenant at Caen came from a completely different background. He was the man responsible for the conduct of the war in its main theater, but found himself spending an increasing amount of time in Paris trying to shore up Dauphin's failing political strength. These men had limited influence on the decisions of the council. There was one area where they represented a considerable threat to the Bishop of Lyon and his allies. That was the control of military operations. Because the Dauphin's troops in the field were largely paid from local receipts collected by the commanders on the spot, they were in the last resort a position to make up their minds about whom they regarded as representing the crown. The three provincial marshals on the council could count on the support of most of the officers struggling to maintain French positions in Lower Normandy and the Breton March. In practice, they disposed of such reserves of manpower as the French government still had. So we're seeing the Dauphin starting to get some new defenders on his side. Of course, they regard Charles of Navarre as a danger. But, you know, there's one thing that is coming up, and that is in 1358, we have another outbreak of the bubonic plague. So when you see all these people streaming into Paris from the countryside, you can imagine what happens when the plague is going to hit again. Now, the sources for this, the 100 Years' War by Perrois, the 100 Years' War by Nylands, and the 100 Years' War, Volume 2, Trial by Fire, by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.